Good afternoon. So, okay. Last time we went through introducing schedulers, and we talked about how the Xv6 scheduler worked. We mentioned that it had this peculiar design where, as far as the mechanics of switching to and from the correct program, there was this separate scheduler thread. We needed to worry about, well, what if we trigger an event that causes the scheduler to run while the scheduler is already running, and we use this lock, which we'll talk about later, which, among other things, disabled interrupts, like the timer interrupt, temporarily, so we wouldn't have that problem. We talked, along with this, about threads versus processes. I mentioned XV6, every process has one thread, so they kind of conflate the two, but later on we're going to deal with threads as something where a process can have more than one of them. And we'll talk about scheduling threads. And we looked at the problem of scheduling on something like a desktop or laptop or phone system. And we had this model of, well, what are programs doing that we need to worry about scheduling? And we thought of programs of having these CPU bursts, that they alternate between waiting for some sort of input. The input could be from a user, could be from another program, it could be from the network, could be from the disk, but waiting for some sort of input, you know, IO operation to complete, and doing some computation based on that. And that model is going to be important because we're going to think about most of our scheduling algorithms in terms of programs that are doing that and what that means as far as our actual goals. And we talked about some very concrete goals. So one of them was turnaround time, which is the time from when these threads became runnable to when they became not runnable. And presumably during that time, they would run for a while in order to do whatever they needed to do, and they'd be not runnable either because they finished or because they're waiting for some piece of I.O. Talked about wait time, which is just a variant on turnaround time where you subtract the time the program is actually running. You can think of this as measuring sort of the what time you're losing because other things are happening on the machine. And then we had goals which were in a very different metric. So we talked about throughput, which is, are we getting full use of out of our CPU? It's the amount of useful work done per unit time. And our primary concern was that because the scheduler was switching from one program to the other, and also because the scheduler needed to do things like figure out what program to run, that we'd have some cost that was spending CPU time that wasn't useful work that we actually wanted to do. Like the scheduler, we have to do it, but you don't think of it as something where, yes, I'm excited to get my new desktop so I can run a scheduler really well. That's not what we think. We think we want the applications to run really well. And we also talked about fairness. And to start out, we were thinking about sort of one program per user. So in that case, fairness is like, are we treating the programs, and therefore the different users, in some sense, equitably. And I mentioned that that sort of has, sort of, is vague. And there's other metrics we might have which are also similarly vague. So I'm going to start by talking a little about metrics and then go on to talk about concrete schedulers. So the questions before I move on. Yes? Don't think my mic's on? Apparently it is, because that works, but apparently it's super non-sensitive. And also at maximum. I guess I can use the backup mic, which presumably, nope, okay, that doesn't help very much. Okay. Oh, that, I can try to use the other mic and see if that helps and doesn't cause feedback. Okay. So, other questions? So, a note about metrics. So today, I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about minimizing mean or total turnaround time. This is the time from when I mentioned from when a thread becomes ready to when it's done being ready to when it's not runnable anymore. And the reason we're focusing on this is that this is an approximation of interactivity or responsiveness on something like a desktop. Because, remember, we mentioned becomes runnable. You can think of, like, I press a key, and the program now acts on that key press. Not runnable, it's waiting for the next key press, so it presumably did whatever that key press asked to do. So that's our intuition as to why this matters and why we want to minimize some average or some of this. And we're going to focus on that. But this is, I said, an imperfect approximation of what we call interactivity or responsiveness. This is because, like, I have a very precisely defined measure, and I'm actually trying to measure how good, you know, my subjective experience of using the desktop is. And because I'm giving an example of where this would probably disagree. So it's something that could happen. My machine make me disagree. Yeah.
Perhaps if you're trying to, you also want to worry about response time. So it may be ideal to have better like turnaround time in one case, but it's going to affect the response time in the process.
Okay, so you're saying that, like, there's a particular program I want to worry about how long it takes to respond, and I'm going to overall help the turnaround time. So there's a question of prioritization, that when I talk about mean or total turnaround time, I mean I'm going to treat, in some sense, all the programs equally. So this means, for example, I'm going to say my compiler, which is reading from the disk, you know, it's going to have low turnaround times because I'm going to run it quickly after we have data from the disk for it, assuming it doesn't take too long. And that might mean that I run, like, the thing that my web browser is slower. So this is not prioritizing programs based on whether they actually are communicating with humans. And that's a way in which this, like, might not be the actual right thing to do if you, like, really care about how usable is my desktop. Like, we don't actually take into account, is the program being used by a human? That's not a factor in this definition. And this might seem like a problem, and in fact, you know, there are OSs which don't use this metric because they want to take into account, are you actually communicating with the keyboard or not? So any other issues? People think, yeah.
Like, maybe if you access memory that's not cached, it would take longer to retrieve to actually display.
So you're saying, like, some programs will be slow because of, like, things aren't in cache. And in some sense, we're saying that rather than necessarily speeding up those programs, maybe it would end up being better to, you know, run them later or something like that. And that's another concern, is that we're prioritizing things based on what's, as it turns out, based on what's going to be fast, not what's going to be important. And therefore, we might make programs which are slower to make other things faster that we don't care about. So I just wanted you to keep that in mind, because we're going to, like, talk about the perfect solution for this imperfect approximation. So it actually won't be a perfect scheduler. It will be a imperfect scheduler. But it's a good approximation in practice, it turns out. I'm going to start with two trivial scheduling algorithms, which clearly will not actually optimize this metric. But we're going to look at how do these act as far as turnaround time goes. And to keep things simple to start out with, I'm going to just assume I have multiple programs ready at almost the same time, and I'm going to assume they have an order. Because for things like first come, first served, as you might guess by the name, we need to know what comes first. So I'm just going to choose an order, even though we're saying they're ready at basically the same time. And we'll look at, like, does that order matter? So let's start by looking at first come, first served. So this is, I think, the absolute simplest scheduling algorithm you can think of. It's even simpler than what XV6 does. We just says a program comes in, it's ready to run. We run it until it can't run anymore. So there's no what we'll call preemption. In XV6, if a program's running, we might preempt it, meaning stop it in the middle of what it's doing, to run something else. In first come, first served, we're not doing that. We're just going to run the program that we get to, keep running it until it's done using things. So to give an example of this, let's say I have my three threads, A, B, and C. And I have an amount of CPU time they need until they become not runnable. So this is the length of their CPU burst in some arbitrary time units. And you can think of this as saying that program A is kind of like CPU bound, like it's doing some big computation apparently, and program B and C are like look like they're I/O bound. That would be our guess based on these CPU times, though of course, as you know, we alluded to when I said, was turnaround time a good metric? I don't know. Like, all I know is this is how long they take. So if they arrive in the order ABC, this is what our schedule is going to look like. We're going to run A for 24 time units, B for 4, C for 3. And then we can compute the wait and turnaround times. So I'll start with turnaround times. So A was ready at time 0 and stopped being ready at time 24. So it has a turnaround time of 24 units. B was ready at time 0, because we said our assumption is they all arrive at roughly the same time, so they're all ready at time 0 and not before then, not after, and finished at time 28, so it has a 28 unit turnaround time, and C, by similar logic, is 31, so we can compute a mean from that. There's also wait time. Is another sort of version of this metric. And for wait time, I just say, okay, A is was ready at time 0, finished at time 24, but spent 24 units of time doing computation, so it waited 0 seconds. Or another way to put it is that there's no time between when A was ready and when it finished when it wasn't running. Versus B, there were 24 units of time between when it was ready and when it finished that it wasn't running. So wait time is very related to turnaround time, and it turns out that optimizing mean wait time and mean turnaround time do the same thing. Just because to get the wait time, you just are subtracting a constant. Okay. Now, for first come, first served, this order that things came in really, really matters. So for example, if things arrived in the order BCA, this is our schedule, and as far as turnaround time goes, this is going to give us a very different result. So our turnaround time is going to be, for A, 31 units, because A started at time 0, finished at 31, so it had 7 units of time during which it wasn't doing anything and wasn't running, so 7 units of wait time, and B has a turnaround time of 4. It runs first. It doesn't have any wait time. And C has a turnaround time of 7, ran after those 4 units of B. So our mean turnaround time is way lower. Okay. And this is a common phenomenon with the simplest possible scheduler, first come, first served. And the big reason why we probably don't want to use it on something like a desktop, we get this, what's known as a convoy effect, that we have these things which don't have very much to do, but they're really heavily delayed and disadvantaged by this long computation. So this is what we can call a convoy effect. They have to wait in line behind this big, long thing. So the order clearly matters here. And we're going to look at this in more detail later. This is sort of a disadvantage of being so simple, is that because I'm just taking the order things come in. I'm not actually making an intelligent decision about what do I want to do. And sometimes, you know, the result is probably not going to be what I want. So our second scheduling algorithm is going to be round robin. So round robin is going to be our preemptive scheduling algorithm, meaning that we're going to interrupt programs before they finish. And this is going to give us a way to avoid that convoy effect, that we're not going to let A keep running the whole time. We're going to stop it and run B and C before it finishes, so we won't be as susceptible to that problem. And our policy is going to be that we're going to run the program until either it can't run anymore, so just like first come, first served, or we decided it ran for too long. And this is essentially what XV6 ends up doing, because we have this timer interrupt, and that's how we decide it ran for too long. So most implementations of round robin typically decide on an amount of time a program is allowed to run for, which we'll call its time quantum. And this is an important choice because, as we'll see, it's going to affect performance a lot. Now, round robin, you know, I said it's the simplest preemptive scheduling algorithm, but it means that we need to do this preemption, this stopping programs in the middle of their work. So we need a way of interrupting programs. And we saw XV6 has that with the timer interrupt. And we need a good way of switching to another program, stopping the program in the middle of its work. And we saw that we have these context switches. So XV6 has those features, so we can do that. If we didn't have good context switch support, or we didn't have something like a timer interrupt, we couldn't use this scheduler. So let's look at what round robin does with our same example as before. We have this long A and these short B and C. And I have different orders. And the order matters because we're doing the same thing as first come, first served as far as what do we run next. We just take the first thing on our list. And when we're finished running something and it's still runnable, we just put it at the end of our list. This is where the name round robin comes from, because we just go in a circle, effectively looking at our list of things that are runnable. And this gives us this fast alternating pattern you can see here. Which, you know, makes sense. So we have these short waiting times in this case. Or these relatively the same waiting times, because we're all alternating as far as when we're not running. So we can see that round robin, like, we alternate everyone, and eventually we get to a point where not everyone can run. So that's why A keeps running at the end. Yes, we're going to stop A after one unit of time, but then we're going to say, oh, there's nothing else to run, let's keep running A. So we're not just going to, like, leave the CPU idle. And similarly, like, we don't run C here because it's done. We don't have any more work for it to do. So we can see our waiting time for A is 7, because it turns out that we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 units of time during which A was not running. Or another way we could have computed that is we could say A is ready at time 0, finishes at time 31, so its turnaround time is 31, and it spends 24 units of that time running. So subtract 31 from 24, we got 7. So B also had a wait time of 7, because if we count up all the times from when B is ready and it's not running, we'll get 7 of them, assuming I made this slide correctly. And another way we can say is that B finishes at time 11. It ran for 4 units of those time. So 11 minus 4 gives us a wait time of 7, and we have this 11 turnaround time for B. And the order, you can see, it affected things slightly, but it had a lot less effect because we were trading off between them. And if we think back to our metrics, this is a sense in which round robin is a lot more fair. That if we look at wait time, all the programs are getting basically the same wait time. So we're being fair about what sort of service they get. Even though it's the case, just because they take, need a lot of different amounts of CPU, that of course they don't all finish at the same time, and they don't all get the same amount of CPU time in total, but they couldn't get all the same amount of CPU time in total and also do all the things they want to do. Now, I mentioned that we have this time quantum, and here I've chosen one unit, but we could have chosen a different number, and that's going to change our schedule. And it's going to give us less of this fairness, that we're going to have more variation based on who went first. So here, A is getting a bit of an advantage, and B is getting a bit of an advantage for going first. It turns out A's advantage doesn't really work out, but B's does, because B went second and not third. Now B has a lower wait time, because it got to go before C more than it did previously. So we get slightly different performance from these different time quantum. And the question is, well, what time quantum should we choose? And if you're thinking about fairness, you might say, okay, we should choose the lowest one. And we'll look at, like, what are our considerations? That's what we're going to think of. So this is round robin. And to write it down, like, we're going to choose that time quantum, and we're going to switch to the next thing that's ready when it expires. We're going to push it back to the end. And this is really what the Xv6 scheduler was doing, even though they didn't have an explicit ready queue. They just iterated through the processes and didn't have an actually explicit time quantum. They just hoped that timer interrupts roughly match that, even though that's not always quite the case. Like, for example, if we switch to a program, you know, because of I/O, then the timer interrupt won't happen the same amount of time as if we switched to it from the last timer interrupt, because the timer interrupts are like every second, not every second, but like something like every second, but we might switch in like half a second after one. But approximately, this is what Xv6 is doing, just the time quantum might vary a little bit. Yeah. Can I explain how I witches? The wait time for what? Why is it 7 for A? For the time quantum of 2? For both of them? So for one way we can compute the wait time is we can say, what's the time from when A was ready to when it finished? That's 31, and subtract how long it was running, which was 24. And that, assuming that gives us 7. I always worry that I might have done a math error on these slides, which has happened. And that's true in both of these cases, for both 1 and 2. Another way we can count out the wait time is we can say, how much time was A runnable but not running? And we see that we have 4 units plus 3 units in this second case. When A was runnable, because we hadn't finished yet, and we know there's no like I/O happening, and didn't run. Okay, other questions?
Does interrupt still happen?
The question is, does interrupt still happen? So, commonly systems that are careful about their choice of time quantum will set the timer interrupt for a particular rate and like keep a counter to figure out when they actually want to switch to another program. So Xv6 is keeping things super simple, so they just say every time there's a timer interrupt, we'll switch. But it's more common for other OSs to try to actually figure out, well, how much time has passed, does it meet my threshold, and not depend on that exactly matching up with the timer interrupt rate. But obviously, that's more complicated. That's why Xv6 doesn't do that. Other questions? Yeah.
How costly is a process context switch with respect to the time quantum?
Question, how costly is a process context switch with respect to a time quantum? We'll get to that. That is a good question, and gets us to our next topic. Other questions? So, as far as choosing this quantum, we have sort of a spectrum. And one way I like thinking about the time quantum is that if we set the quantum to infinity, then it's just first come, first served. Because first come, first served is just round robin where we never decide to preempt. If we wait forever to preempt, we'll never do it. And as you make the quantum lower and lower, you get more and more of this, that sort of like tightly interleaved round robin. But, and that has an advantage for fairness. So first come, first serve, we saw, like, really favors the first program. So the first program gets really lucky. The second program and third program get really unlucky, relatively speaking. Whereas round robin, it's more fair. That there's none of that sort of preference. But we have these context switches. And I sort of drew these context switches as if they were instantaneous. They didn't affect the total time everything took, but that's not really true. So we're going to have lower throughput with shorter quantum because we're going to be context switching more frequently. So we're going to have to do, some choice which balances these two factors, that even if we want to be perfectly fair, we don't want to be perfectly fair by running nothing. So that is a perfectly fair scheduler. Just don't run anything ever. Treats every program equally. But you wouldn't be very happy with that. And as we make smaller and smaller time quantums, we're getting closer and closer to that ideally fair scheduler that doesn't run anything ever because of the overhead of the context switches. So to think about this, we need to think about, well, what is a context switch overhead like? So empirical measurements made relatively recently give us an overhead of like 10 to 100 microseconds. Now, this is tricky to measure because most of the cost of the context switch is not actually in the time from like when a timer interrupt happens to when we return in the other program. But it's because of things like caches. And this measurement is trying to take caches into account. But of course, how much the cache matters depends on what program you're running. And that's why there's such a huge range. And the range could be even huger if you have programs which are like really dependent on keeping things in cache versus really don't. And this is the sort of measurements people have gotten. So it's a pretty significant cost by the terms of the actual amount of time we'll want to do. And when we're choosing a time quantum for round robin or for other schedulers we'll talk about which are related to round robin, where we have to choose how long do we let something run before looking for something else, we want to manage this overhead. So to give a concrete example, the current Linux default scheduler chooses a time quantum between 3/4 of a millisecond and 6 milliseconds. And historically, numbers have been like 1 to 100 has been typical, like that whole range. And if we think about that sort of range, we're usually working on like 1 to 0.1% overhead, maybe a bit higher in the case of the low end of Linux's range. And that's sort of the choice we're making, that it's okay to have 1% overhead in order to like not have bad responsiveness that we'd imagine from the unfair scheduler with the large time quantum. So questions about context switch times. So I told you that we had this trade-off here where we have less fairness, higher throughput on one end, more fairness, lower throughput on the other. But I said we'd be spending most of our time on turnaround time, and I didn't put anything about turnaround time on either side of this arrow. So let's think about, well, how should I write turnaround time in this diagram? And since we're talking about time quantums, let's say there's no context switch overhead, keep things simple. If I decrease the time quantum for round robin, will that cause the mean turnaround time to always decrease or stay the same, always increase or stay the same, any combination of those, something else like always stay the same or, you know, stay the same, but depending on how you measure it, give you a minute or two to think about that. Check with your neighbor. You should be able to come up with examples to show like what happens. Saying that we like compare one time quantum to a smaller one. Okay, so who thinks A is the best answer? B, C, D, something else like always stay the same or depends how you measure it? Okay, so I think C is the best answer. And I'm going to give some concrete examples which show all the cases, increasing, decreasing, staying the same. Now, note that the way this question was asked, that we said if there were no context switch overhead. So before I go to my examples, what happens if there's context switch overhead? Why, how might that change things? Yeah. Yeah, so eventually, we'll have so many context switches that we'll be spending like most of our time context switching, so the programs won't get work done, so we'll just keep increasing the turnaround time. I say eventually because we have to get the time quantum really low before for that to happen, like really, really low relative to the context switch overhead, which I mentioned, typically we aim for like 1-ish percent, you know, maybe 10%, shouldn't be anywhere bad enough to cause that. But I just wouldn't want people to think about that issue with this. We're working simpler. So let's think about increasing the turnaround time. So here's an example. I have two programs that both need 1 unit of time with a time quantum of run. We run run for 1 second, one for the other. The mean turnaround time is 1.5 because one finished in 1 unit, that are finished at 2, take the average, 1.5. If we alternate more frequently, then the one that finished at time 1 now finishes at time 1.5, so we've increased the turnaround time. And you might say, from examples like this, think, well, this is how things work. Well, it looks like increasing fairness like this just had the direct consequence of increasing turnaround time. But this only really happened in this case because these two programs were exactly the same. And that's not always the case. So to give a simple example of decreasing, let's say A needs 10 units, B needs 1. We can have this scenario where with a large time quantum, we run A first and B has to wait behind it, whereas with a short one, we run B sooner and therefore decrease the turnaround time. Okay, so questions? Example. As for staying the same, the simplest way to have them stay the same, but not the only way, is just have the time quantum start from larger than how long things need to run and decrease it to still larger than how long things need to run. In which case, you get exactly the same schedule, so nothing changes. There are also probably examples where the schedule changes and you still get the same turnaround time, but didn't need to go there. We have this simple counterexample that maybe seems a little contrived. So that's on sort of round robin and turnaround time. So we're going to look at turnaround time with respect to first come, first serve, just to start out, and think about how arrival order affected it. We saw that we had this big problem where programs which took a long time delaying other programs made us have long turnaround time. So let's go through this example where I should have swapped these. Sorry, because that's not what I wrote. Of all the three orders are relevant here, and look at the turnaround times and waiting times, and we see we got the lowest turnaround time over here. And what's happening is that in the case with the highest turnaround time, or ABC order, we're waiting for A, while in B and C. So we're kind of accumulating turnaround time in both B and C while A is running. And A takes the longest time, so we're accumulating the most turnaround time we can. Whereas in this example, we have the same type of scenario. We're accumulating turnaround time in B and A because they're waiting and not running while C runs, but that's the least amount of time possible that they could be waiting because C is the shortest program. And we can see that when we do some other order that's in between, we get an in-between result for our turnaround and waiting time. Another way of viewing this is that we're trying to stop programs from running as soon as possible because, we're kicking the clock as long as a program is ready but not running. And in general, it turns out that if we want the lowest total or mean turnaround time, we run the shortest CPU burst first. If we want the worst, we run the longest first. And we can think of this as race to go to sleep. We want to get things sleeping, not runnable, as soon as possible. Or another way we can think about it is we want to minimize the time that two threads are waiting for something to happen by getting one thread finished earlier. Okay. And this observation we're going to use later to make a scheduler that actually minimizes mean turnaround time. And we're going to say, okay, now we know what we have to do to get lowest mean turnaround time. We're going to make our scheduler do this thing that we saw accidentally happening with first come, first serve when we just chose the right order by presumably choosing the right order. But first, I'm going to talk about a different kind of scheduler that we're going to kind of think of as both a useful kind of scheduler to make and also a useful tool for making schedulers like the one we're going to get to that minimizes mean turnaround time. And this scheduler you can think of as being motivated by a very different kind of scheduling metric, one we haven't talked about. And common cases like I just have things that are more important than other things. Like, I want my shells to always respond quickly. I want them to always run instead of being computations and run first, run faster, unconditionally. Or, you know, I have a shared system with faculty and students, and because, you know, the faculty are the ones who complain to me more loudly, I'm going to have the faculty stuff run first before the student stuff. So these are like common goals system administrators might have. And we might want a scheduling algorithm which does this, that if we have a shell, it runs it first so people don't complain, why is my shell so slow, even if that means we're doing horrible things to their big compute jobs. Because those people don't complain as much, you know, aren't as frustrated. Or, you know, I want to run the faculty things because the faculty can actually like maybe get me fired. And the students can't, so I'll run the faculty stuff first so they don't complain. And there's a scheduling algorithm for this known as priority scheduling. And a usual way we make this is that we have a bunch of queues. So I talked about having a ready queue. So our traditional view of a priority scheduler is we split our ready queue into a set of queues, one for each priority level. This is our conceptual division. And we have a highest priority, which I'll say is 15 here. We might order things differently at some point. And we'll choose a process from the ready queue with the highest priority. If there's nothing at the highest priority, we'll go down to the next one and so on. And within a priority, we'll do some other scheduling algorithm. Most commonly, we'll like do round robin between the things at priority 15. If there's nothing to run at priority 15, we'll go down to priority 14, assuming 15 is the highest, most important priority level. People differ in how they number things, whether, you know, 15 is the most important one or 0 is. So to implement our like faculty programs run before students, we just put all the faculty programs at priority 15, all the student programs at priority 0, and we've achieved that policy. And I said this is for the ready queue. We have to remember the program's priority, so when we put it back on the queue after it wasn't running, we choose the right queue to put it back on. You just remember what's its priority or figure that out whenever it becomes ready to run. Questions? Scheduler? Yes.
Why is this design chosen over like a priority queue?
So question is, why don't we just use a priority queue? So sometimes they do. The reason you'd want to choose separate queues is because of this choice of what you do for things at the same priority. That's a little tricky to do with a priority queue directly. But if, for example, each process has its own unique priority, then a priority queue would be a better choice. Yes?
Is this what Windows does? Because I remember the task manager, like, you can, on the new processes, you can kind of, like, right-click them and change their priority.
So the question is this what, like, Windows or other real OSs do? And the answer is sometimes. So sometimes there's a priority you see exposed for threads or processes, which is precisely this kind of priority. Sometimes there's something which might be more accurately called like a nice value, where there's maybe something like this going on underneath, but there's some mapping from your value to the real priority that's less direct and might change over time. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
So like with the lower ones, does it wait completely for like 15 to complete before running?
So the question is, if 15 is what's run first, does that mean the lower ones wait for it to complete? Yes. So what if what I'm telling you you know, this is, you know, higher priority always runs first. And in fact, usually this will be preempted. So if something higher priority comes along and you're running at priority zero, well, that's too bad. You're not important. That other thing is we're going to run it right away. Doesn't matter. So with that in mind, let's think of a scenario here. So I have two programs. At highest priority, I have process A here, which does one unit of I/O, 10 units of CPU, alternates that indefinitely. And priority Z is my big computation. It's at the lowest priority, so it doesn't disrupt those other users, so they don't complain to me. And it needs to do 400 units of CPU before it completes. So how long is process Z going to take to complete? I'll give you like a minute. You can check with your neighbor that you agree on the answer. Okay, so someone have an answer for me? Yeah. 40,000. So how did you get that?
If the only time process Z runs is during the 1 unit of process A IO, and so it only runs for 1 unit every 10 units that process A.
Okay, so that's, so you're saying it all, because it only runs during the IO, so that's 1 every 10. Slightly miscounted, it's 1 every 11.
Oh.
So it's a little slower than that even. So it's a little over 40,000 units of time that it takes. Yeah, so because basically process A always runs first. Maybe process E could keep running, but doesn't get to. We have priority. A is more important. A always gets to run right away. So how about this variant? I have something that acts like process A, process B, at the second highest priority. Now, how long will process E take to complete? I'll give you a minute for this. Time. There's an answer back there. So 484,000. Okay. Any other answers? So like roughly 10 times what we had before. Any other answers? Yeah.
I have
4.8 million. 5 million. Any other answers? So like 100 times what we had before. Okay. So the answer I get is Z doesn't complete. So let's think about, so the people who were doing like 10 times more, 11 times more, were like thinking like, okay, so B gets to run its 10 units of work in between A's. And that's right. Yeah, B is going to run, so B is going to take 11 times 10 units of time between when it gets to do IOs. But when it does its IO, it's going to take one, that IO is going to take 1 unit of time, And your hope was that, oh, during that one unit of time, B's doing I/O, then Z gets to run. But unfortunately, that's not the case. During that one unit of time when B's doing its I/O, A gets to run. And we know A is not also doing I/O because for A to have done I/O, it would have to have done 10 units of work since its last I/O, and we know its last I/O was when B started. So Z never gets to run, ever. Yes. So question, is there a possibility that IOs overlap? So in general, yes, but not with this setup. With this setup, the IOs can't overlap because A's IO is always finished by the time before B gets to do its, by the time B gets to run in the middle of A's IO. So there's no extra space, there's no overlapping. So if the timings were different, maybe the IOs would occasionally overlap, and we'd get something more like that, like millions result for units. So this problem here, where Z, doesn't get to finish, and even if we tweak these times a little bit, it takes, thousands of times longer to finish. This is known as starvation. That process is never, or essentially never, get resources because of the higher priority. And this is the reason when I introduced our scheduling metrics, I talked about fairness. Because this is the big complaint people have when they look at sort of priority-based schemes and some things based on them we'll look at later, is that they're really unfair. That, yes, you said that you wanted to prioritize faculty over students, but you didn't mean you wanted students to never run anything. And that's what we'll do. That's what priority means. It means, really, the higher priority things have priority. If they can use all the CPU time, too bad, you're at a lower priority, you don't get it. So I talked about priority schedulers, and initially, I introduced this as sort of these administrative goals, and that is the most obvious use of priority schedulers. But we're going to do this to minimize turnaround time. I told you the best order was to run the shortest CPU burst first. So we're going to implement the minimize turnaround time scheduler by doing a priority scheduler where the priority is the CPU burst length. And for now, we'll ignore preemption. We'll add back in preemption later, which is typical in priority schedulers, but we're going to have to do a little extra work for preemption to actually minimize turnaround time. First, I'll look at this without preemption, and then we'll figure out how do we add back in preemption and make it actually achieve our goal. So there's a bit of a practical problem. I need to know what the length of the CPU burst is. And in all my examples, I just told you, and you might say, okay, that's not how the real schedulers work. Like, when I write my program, I don't write down my CPU burst takes 3 milliseconds in my program. I never did that. So how can we do this? We'll deal with this problem later, but only kind of. We're not going to have a great solution. There's just not a great solution. So let's look at our non-preemptive scheduler in here. I'm going to do an example, and we're going to call this non-preemptive scheduler shortest job first, or SJF. And I have 3 different programs which alternate between CPU and I/O, and just have this constant pattern just to keep things simple. And we're going to assume that at the initial time, they're all ready to run, and we're going to make a choice. Well, priority-wise, we're going to say program B, highest priority because it has the shortest CPU burst, program A has the lowest priority because it's the longest, and program B is in the middle. So our priority scheduling is going to be we're going to run program B, then program B is going to do an I/O. The arrow in this picture represents the I/O starting and finishing. Then we're going to run program C because it has the next highest priority. Then we're going to run program A. And because I'm not doing preemption yet, even though program B finishes while program A is running, it doesn't run immediately. And you can see that, well, we're probably not going to achieve our goal of low turnaround time without preemption, because you see program B is waiting behind program A. That's increasing our turnaround time by more than if we just ran program B first in that case. And we can see that, like, really extremely when we have these short things that manage to start in the middle of program A running. And why did we run program A first? Well, because it was the only thing that could run at that time. So this convinces us we need a preempted version of this. And the reason we need a preemptive version is that though this works when we have multiple things ready to run, we're choosing the right order. So for example, at the beginning, we're running B first, and after A finishes, we correctly run B first and not C to lower our turnaround time. We need to handle the case of we made a mistake. We ran A, but we really shouldn't have run A. We made a mistake because B and C are more important right now. We just didn't know B and C would complete. So we're going to solve this with preemption, where we're going to use preemption to say, we accidentally started the long task, we want to fix that, we have a shorter one to run now, let's run the shorter one. But there's a little catch. So you might say, looking at this, that okay, I'm just always going to run B first, and then C if I can't run B, and then A. And if you do that, you won't actually minimize turnaround time. So why? So what's the problem with just always running B or C over A? Why isn't that going to minimize turnaround time? Where are we going to get into trouble? And what to think about is look at this situation right here. So what happens if we run B right there? Yeah.
Because A always has that like block of I/O. Like if you don't like run A, like I don't know how to say it, but like basically it always keeps getting pushed back.
Okay, so you're worried about pushing back A's I/O. That's a concern. But we have, I guess maybe no. Here is not the rightest example, but we're close. Like here. Here we actually want to run B, but if I move this over a little bit, we don't. Sorry, I gave you the wrong question. So what is going on there? There's something about that, yeah.
Extra context switches.
So you're saying there's extra context switches, but we're, yeah. So that's a concern, but we're not going to talk about minimizing context switches in this, but that is a concern. Like, if we're switching rapidly when we could not switch rapidly for almost no cost, that would be a big issue, yeah. Yeah, so it's very related to the idea of we're doing these extra context switches, but the issue is that A just had a very little work to do, right? So it's kind of like we're going to switch to A just for a teeny little bit of time and then switch back later on. We might as well have just continued A, because that's going to make A wait for not the wait for that time. And yes, we're going to wait for a little extra time for B, but it's not much relative to how long B is going to take. And so this is the issue we have to deal with. If a long job is running and a short job interrupts it, you know, that's usually fine. But if it's almost done and we have something not so long compared to what's left done, that's not going to work. So our priority is actually going to need to be dynamic. We're going to need to say, take into account, this thing I've started running is almost done. So the way we're going to do that is we're not going to set our priority to the length of the CPU burst. We're going to set it to the remaining time. And our resulting scheduler will call shortest remaining time first. So we're prioritizing not based on the total, but based on just what's left. So to see, give an example with the same scenario of how that works, so here, the amount of remaining time B had is a bit less than the amount of remaining time A had. So we run B first. B just had less time left, so we want to run it first. We have a little bit of an advantage of running it first, assuming context switches don't matter. And later on, C finishes, but A's almost done. We don't actually want to run C right away. And we won't with the shortest remaining time first scheduler, even though if we were doing static priorities, we'd say, oh, C always runs first, because we're delaying this little sliver of A. And that's going to cost too much for how much it would take to not delay it. Okay. Some questions? This, yeah.
So I definitely think this is more ideal than anything we talked about before. But the problem still remains. Let's say you have program A that's just like 100 or 1,000 times longer than any other program you have in. You're going to continue to get more jobs into the system as time goes on.
So your question is, doesn't this still have starvation? And yes, absolutely. And this is because we're going to prioritize minimizing our mean turnaround time over fairness. Those goals are, in fact, in conflict. We can't avoid starvation and actually minimize turnaround time, because sometimes the best schedule for turnaround time is almost never run A. And that's just how things are. So if we care about starvation, then we better have a scheduling goal that's more complicated than mean turnaround time. Now, so I showed you sort of pictorially, so we can see this intuition that A just had a little left. We want to let it finish rather than run something else. And so we have this like concrete scheduler that seems to do really well for mean turnaround time. And the question is, well, is this the best we can do? And there are some theoretical results for this. So shortest job first, the non-preemptive version, minimizes turnaround time. I should have written that instead of response time. If you disallow preemption and leaving the CPU idle. So if you leave the CPU idle, you can actually do better. Because we can say, oh, I know something's about to finish, let's not run anything so we don't have to preempt. But that's typically not a thing an OS wants to do. So if you don't want to do preemption, shortest job first, well, there's some theoretical results that, yeah, it's best. And SRTF minimizes turnaround time and waiting time if you ignore context switch costs. So if there's no context switch cost, there's some strong theoretical results that no matter what your jobs look like, no matter what your processes look like, no matter what patterns you have, shortest remaining time first is the best you can do, assuming context switches are free. I'm not going to go through that proof because this is not a queuing theory class, but there's, in fact, like very strong proofs of that. Okay, so questions? Oops. And a side on name. So I, in lecture, said SRTF was the preemptive algorithm with remaining time, and SJF was the non-preemptive one with total time, but with not preemption, that's the same as using remaining time, because we only check the remaining time when it's starting. Books sometimes use different names. So for example, some books will call SJF for both versions, just say with preemption, without. I prefer these separate names to emphasize the remaining time thing, that you don't just take the CPU burst, but that's not what everyone does. Okay. So we have this scheduler that minimizes mean turnaround time. So let's just add it to our operating system. All we need to do is know the CPU burst lengths. And that seems hard. So one simple solution for this is that you could ask. You could say, hey, you want to write a program? Tell me how long your CPU bursts are. And Some systems actually do this. So batch schedulers commonly ask programs that are people submitting programs to say, how long is this going to take? Is it going to be an hour, 10 hours, or so on? And use that information. And sometimes users even give accurate answers. Or answers which are within like 30, 40%. But this is not, in general, an effective mechanism and is way less applicable to our like desktop scheduling, where there's so many different CPU bursts and you're not going to get an answer, you're not going to have a way to ask. You might say, okay, so how do we figure that out then? And we might say, maybe there's something in our process control block that can do it, but if you look at all these fields in XV6, none of these really help. Like, there are things which can give us an idea, like we can look at what files it has open and get a guess as to what it's doing, but that's not going to actually give us a number. So we might need to predict what the CPU burst lengths are. And in the worst case, we're not going to have a good answer. Because the worst case is you need to run the program to figure it out. You need to know if the program halts or not. So clearly we can't do that. So we can't always figure it out. But we can have heuristics. And by heuristics, I mean things that don't actually work, but kind of work. And that's what typically we're going to use when we care about minimizing turnaround times. We're going to have heuristics that often work, but sometimes don't work. And our heuristics are usually going to be based on this one key observation, that the CPU bursts I'm seeing the program doing now are going to be the same as the ones it does later. So if I just observe what it does now, later on I can make good estimates of how much remaining time it has for something else. And this happens to work in practice most of the time, because if a program's interactive, like it's using the keyboard or the network, now it's probably going to continue doing so like 10 seconds later, or possibly even minutes or hours later. And if a program is doing like tons of computation now, it's probably still going to be doing tons of computation in 3 minutes if it's still running. So this usually works, but obviously, you can write a program which takes a bunch of keyboard input and then does like 5 minutes of CPU, then takes a bunch of keyboard input rapidly, that violates all these rules. But mostly it works. So we're going to have strategies based on this. And I'm going to finish up today and also go into tomorrow on a classic strategy for doing this, which is going to be based on priority scheduling. And this is a strategy where we're going to take advantage of our priority scheduler having several things at the same priority level. You might say, well, if we're making estimates, why don't we just like get our best estimate and order things that way? But they're estimates. We don't actually know that one is better than the other, so there's actually not much incentive to like assign like precise remaining times to every program. We just really want to separate out these interactive programs from these CPU-heavy programs. That's our real goal. And that's going to help us with these heuristics, that we don't need these heuristics to be like exactly accurate to get a good schedule. We just need them to get the extremes right. We want to distinguish those program A's with long computation from B's and C's, which are short. That's where most of our benefit's going to come from, rather than like trying to order the 3-unit versus 4-unit CPU burst of program B and C, even though that would be nice. No, that's not what we're going to focus on. So a concrete scheduler that does this, some priority scheduling, is going to be something we'll call multi-level feedback queues. And this is going to use something based on priority scheduling to sort of combine both tracking the time estimate and making the scheduling decision. And the benefit of this is that we're going to have like less bookkeeping than if we try to do estimates separately. And this is important because we want to keep our context switch costs low. But our key idea is that we're going to set our priority to be our time estimates. Every program's priority is going to be our current estimate for how long its CPU bursts are. And we're going to divide these time estimates into a relatively small number of buckets. So I'm going to use like 4 buckets on my slides. Real implementations of things like this often use like 64 or hundreds, but like not like every possible number of microseconds. You know, like an actual exact, you know, best estimate you could get would do. And the key thing we're going to do in this scheme is we're going to say, and I'm here, I have my highest priority is at the top here, priority 3, that things at priority 3, we estimate that they need less time, so we're going to give them a smaller time slice. You know, if our estimate is wrong and process A here needs a 200 millisecond CPU burst, we're not going to run it for 200 milliseconds at priority 0. We're just not going to do that because we've learned after the first millisecond that our estimate was wrong. It does not have a short CPU burst. So we're going to enforce our estimates by setting different elapsed time quantum at each level and running in round robin at each level with a particular time quantum. And we're going to observe whether programs actually use that whole time quantum or not to decide how to adjust priority. So if process A runs for 1 whole millisecond, we're going to say our estimate was wrong. That means you shouldn't be at priority 3 here. And we're going to change its priority before we move on. We're not going to continue running it round robin with process B. We're just going to say, sorry, you took too long. You're going to go to a lower priority. So we're dynamically going to adjust the priorities, but the adjustment is going to be something that sort of comes along with just running the programs normally, so we're not going to do much extra work. And this is good because, you know, here I have so many programs, I don't want every time I decide about a program to run to have to check, recompute all my time estimates. So I'm going to do it as I go. And the algorithm we'll use, so I'll set my maximum time slice, my time quantum at each priority. I'll run the highest priority process. In this example, it's process A, which we already knocked down to priority 2. And I'm going to make a decision based on whether it uses the whole time slice. If it does, it's still ready, so I should put it on a queue because I want to run it, right? It wouldn't be right to say, sorry, I thought you weren't going to take much time, so I ran you for a millisecond and then never ran you again. That would not be acceptable. So we're going to put it at a lower priority and keep running the highest priority thing that's left. If A was the only process in the system, that would be A. But it's not, so we'll run B next. The other possibility is that process A finishes early. In that case, we're going to make a guess that maybe your estimate of A's CPU burst was too high, and experimentally move it up to a higher priority. If our guess is wrong, well, then it's going to run for a little bit at that priority and then get demoted. Okay. So this is our basic algorithm. We'll go through the details of how this works and some variations next time, along with some other schedulers.